Welcome back to Module 2 of the Microsoft Virtual Academy, Failover Clustering in Windows Server 2012 R2. I'm Simon Perryman from Five9, joined again by Eldon from Microsoft on the Failover Clustering team. Now, in this second module, we're going to be taking a look at cluster deployments and upgrades. Specifically, we're going to kind of give you an introduction to your different installation options. When you're thinking about first building the cluster, what are the decision points that you have to make here beyond the hardware? How do you install it? How do you connect with Active Directory? How do you then actually go test and build the cluster? We're then going to spend a few minutes exploring the basic management operations, take a look at our membership model, which is known as Quorum, and then last but not least, talk about how you can go and upgrade an older cluster to the latest version 2012 R2. With that, let's go ahead and get started by talking about installation. Eldon, over to you.
All right. So first off, we'll talk about installation of a cluster. So when you're setting up a cluster, the first thing to think about is what is the SKU that you're going to use and what are you going to install for the base operating system? So you're going to be installing the operating system. The first question is going to be, what operating system should I install? Well, the first part is that the failover clustering feature is actually included in all the SKUs of Windows Server. So
Standard Edition as well, right?
And Standard Edition, so whether you're going with Windows Server Standard Edition, with Data Center, and then there's also the choice if you could go with the Microsoft Hyper-V Server 2012 R2. So failover clustering is in all of those features, and you can use any of them to make a highly available solution. Now, when you're looking at these three, there's no functional difference in Hyper-V, there's no functional difference in failover clustering, but there are some differences kind of around licensing. So let's talk about those. And it really kind of spans on what is your licenses for the guest. So on the far kind of left side of the spectrum is the Hyper-V server SKU. And that the host operating system is free, but it comes with no licenses for the guest. So you're going to have to pay for the license of each guest that you put on top of that Hyper-V system.
What happens if you had a Linux guest? Is that an entirely free solution then?
Yeah, it would be an entirely free solution.
I guess we still need Active Directory. Let's not forget about that. So we're still going to need some type of Windows server in the environment that's fully licensed, Active Directory, those key infrastructure services. But as far as that virtualization solution, you get that free host, free guest operating system. That's a compelling reason to use Hyper-V there.
Yep. And in the middle is Windows Server Standard Edition. So with Standard Edition, you get two guest OS licenses. So you'll pay for the host operating system. It's going to be licensed on per two CPUs. And then you'll get two licenses for Windows running on top of that. Now, on the other side of the slider is you're going to have Windows Server 2012 R2 Data Center Edition. And with that, you're going to pay a little more for the host operating system, and it's licensed per two CPUs, but you're going to get all of your guest OS licenses for free. So they're kind of the inverse of each other. If you think about Hyper-V server on the far one side of the spectrum is free OS, free host operating system, but you got to pay for each guest. And on the other side of the spectrum, you've got Data Center, where you're paying for the host operating system, but you're getting all the guest OSs for free.
So tell me a little more about this Hyper-V server. So we said this is free. We actually have the link to go download that as well if you want to go try it out here. Tell us, what are the other key features as well?
With Hyper-V Server 2012 R2, you really have consistent experiences so the bits are the same. So what you see in the free Hyper-V server SKU versus what you get in Standard Edition or in Data Center, the same bits. The biggest difference here is whether you have the graphical user interface, the GUI. So Hyper-V Server doesn't come with the GUI. It comes with the core installation. You can also do core if you wanted to with Standard or Data Center, but that's what comes by default on Hyper-V server SKU. All management is via either remote GUI, so you can install the GUI tools on your remote, let's say on your laptop. So you can install the RSAT remote server administrative toolkit on your laptop, and then you can manage it, or you can also do command line interfaces to manage it as well.
Now, if I had Failover Cluster Manager, the full GUI version, could I go and manage those Hyper-V servers remotely through that GUI?
Absolutely.
If I had Hyper-V server, could I go manage those individual hosts remotely?
From the command line. Yes.
Okay. And then finally, if I had System Center Virtual Machine Manager, could I go manage a cluster that's running this as well with the full GUI?
Absolutely.
Okay. So remote management, key thing here, don't feel limited by the fact that it's kind of command line based. With that full remoting capability, you can get that GUI running on top of it too.
All right, so now let's talk about the OS installation choice. So you have a couple different choices when you're installing the operating system and what you want to do. So we talked a little bit about Hyper-V server SKU coming in core, so not having a GUI. So you actually have some choices with standard and data center in what you want to install and what are the bits installed. So there's core, which is basically, well, let's start with full. So actually, full is what you're used to. When you install Windows Server, you're going to get full, and that's going to give you the full graphical user interface. Now, you can actually go up or down from that point. So you can actually go to full with desktop experience. If you go up, what that's actually going to do is give you kind of the beautiful Windows and
the Aero theme with the smooth filtering and all that right. Nice visualization.
Exactly how it kind of looks on your client. So if you install Windows 8.1 client, you're going to get that kind of beautiful user experience around the shell and the arrow, and you can get that on server. So if you're going to be using server as your desktop, which you could do, you might want to install full desktop. But if you're running a server, you probably don't want to install full desktop. If it's a real server, like a SQL server, Hyper-V server, you don't want to install full desktop. Now, you can actually go down. So let's talk about stripping down the operating system. So it starts with full, and then the next layer down is called min shell. So what min shell does is that you actually strip out the shell. So you have no Windows Explorer. You have no Internet Explorer. And it's actually, you've stripped down the operating system. But what you do still have is all the MMCs and management tools. So for example, you want to provision a disk. Now you can do that from PowerShell, but maybe you're not used to the syntax and you want the simplicity of the GUI. So what you can do is you can open up diskmanagement.msc and you can actually go and create partitions, delete partitions, format disks. You have Server Manager, so you can configure networking. You can join the servers to the domain. You can open Failover Cluster Manager, and you can manage the cluster. So all the GUI management tools are there from a server perspective, but it's stripped down and you don't have Internet Explorer and Windows Explorer. Now, the next layer down even further is you can strip those GUI management tools out and get down to what we call core, a core installation. And so with core, you actually remove all the MMCs, all the management tools, and it gives you the smallest footprint of all of them installed. And you can actually dynamically change between all of these. So let's say you deploy a server and you say, you know what, I'm going to deploy with core. And after you've deployed it and you're trying to troubleshoot and you're maybe struggling with using PowerShell for troubleshooting, you say, you know what, I want min shell, I want some of my GUI tools back. You can actually dynamically change between one and the other, just a simple reboot. You install the package through install.windows feature and then reboot and then you're back at min shell. Or you can go to full, or you can go to full with desktop. So you can actually transition the server back and forth.
Now, a couple of years ago when Core first came out, we were heavily promoting that as the best deployment option for a cluster. The reason for that being, since there was things, no Internet Explorer, no GUI, it meant that there were less patches, less updates, which meant fewer reboots, which meant fewer downtime. So that was great for a high availability system. But Alden, I understand that's kind of changed now. Can you talk about how the newer servicing model has slightly adjusted that recommendation?
Yeah, so we've kind of evolved the servicing model. So there's a couple value props when you're talking about should I strip down the operating system. First of which is the attack surface. So if you think about full versus core, with core you're going to have far few binaries installed, far few services running, no shell, no explorer, no GUIs, and you're actually going to have a smaller attack surface. So from a security perspective, core is going to give you a better, smaller security footprint. Now from a servicing model, it used to be one of the ways we used to talk about core was that if a hotfix came out for Internet Explorer, that you wouldn't have to install that fix because Internet Explorer isn't a fix, which would reduce the amount of patches you have to install, which would reduce your downtime, which is very important for high availability. Now, we've actually changed our servicing model some, and what we do now is that we've actually gone to kind of this cumulative updates that happen once a month. So basically the way that works is that when a hotfix comes out for, let's say, Internet Explorer, and then a hotfix comes out for NTFS, then a hotfix comes out for, let's say, clustering, we used to release those as all these separate packages, and you as a customer had this burden of trying to figure out which ones were for me, didn't apply, did I have this installed, yes or no, and a lot of complexity. So we've simplified all that. So basically what we do is we take all the fixes that release over a month, we kind of squirrel them all up, and then we do a single test pass with all of those hotfixes together, and then we release them as a single package and a single release. So every patch Tuesday, we release this roll-up. And so the roll-up is basically all the hotfixes of the last month, And then you just basically need to install that one package. So whether you're running core or Mint Shell or full with desktop even, you're basically going to take that single hotfix, which is the roll-up, once a month, one patch, one reboot, and you're done. So core from a patching perspective doesn't, we've evolved our servicing story to make it much more simplified. So I wouldn't necessarily choose the install package based off of servicing per se.
But there are certainly other benefits, smaller OS installation footprint, smaller attack surface for security reasons. So what's the best recommendation? If you can use core, go ahead and do it.
Use core if you can.
And manage everything remotely, right?
Yep. I think it really goes down to what's your management experience. So if you're comfortable with PowerShell, go with core. Also remote management. So if you're comfortable with doing remote management, go with core, because that's going to allow you to use your GUI tools remotely and manage, give you that smaller OS image, attack surface. It's going to give you some value there.
So moving on now, talking about installing the failover cluster and feature. Can you clarify, is this a feature or a role? How do we get this up and running once I've got my OS installed?
So there's kind of this, how do we pick?
Well, what is it? What's clustering?
What's a service? What's a role or a feature? So this is like the internal development, geek fact. So basically the way we defined a feature versus a role is that if you were walking, this is how we mentally thought about this, is that if you're walking through a data, through your server room, and you point at a server, and you go, that's my blah, that's a role. So if you walk through and you go, that's my SQL server, that's my Exchange server, that's my DHCP server, that's my Hyper-V server, that's a role. Now what you wouldn't do is you wouldn't walk through the data center and go, that's my failover cluster. People would be like,
and what does it do?
And what does it do, right? So those are features. So you wouldn't walk through and say, that's my MPIO server, right? MPIO is a feature which enables a role, is an enabler of a role, and failover clustering is a feature as well, unless that's a role. So that's why you'll see, when you're going through Server Manager, the add and role wizard, which you'll see up here, is that there's two tabs there. There's roles and there's features, and you'll find Hyper-V. So just think about that. If Hyper-V, DHCP server, anything you'd walk through the server room and point at it, that's your role, and then features enable roles.
And then actually launching everything, we do that through Failover Cluster Manager.
All right, so let's talk about some Active Directory considerations when joining, when setting up a cluster. So there's a couple different modes which you can actually install a cluster. First off, cluster nodes need to be domain joined, but there's kind of some Active Directory integration points that you can choose now. So there's the traditional clusters that you've known for the last decade where the nodes need to be domain joined, and we go and create computer objects associated with those names. But we also have a new mode in Windows Server 2012 R2, which we call AD Detached Clusters, and that allows you to create clusters without creating computer objects associated with them. So that gives you some flexibility. We'll kind of walk through these two scenarios as we go here. So let's talk about some fundamental requirements as we think about clusters. So first off, as I talked about, all the nodes must be domain joined and they must be members of an Active Directory domain.
No work group.
No work groups. So you got to be in a domain. And they have to be in the same domain. And the servers, and they must be member servers. So you can't have the nodes in your cluster be domain controllers. So in a domain, in the same domain, member servers. And we really want the domain functional level, so we want that Active Directory domain functional level to be Windows Server 2003 minimum. And we really kind of recommend getting to Windows Server 2008 domain functional level.
Don't forget Server 2003 end of life, middle of the summer 2015. So you want to make sure that you're being progressive and upgrade from that old one. Yep.
And we also recommend putting all the nodes in the same OU, organizational unit, within Active Directory. And the reason you want to do that is so that you get the same group policies applied to all nodes. So you could end up with a supportability issue where if you have nodes in different OUs, different group policies being applied to them, suddenly you fail over from one node to the other and it doesn't work as you expect. And that's because you're getting different group policies applied. So put them in the same OU so they get the same group policies. Now, we can work with any domain, like I said, we want domain functional level of 2003 or higher. We can work with 2003 domain controllers as well. But there's some features that require you to have higher level domain versions. So specifically, if you want to use BitLocker, you need to have a Windows Server 2012 R2 domain controllers in the mix. It don't have to be the 2012 R2 domain functional level, but you do have to have 2012 R2 domain controllers accessible. So let's talk about kind of an overview of what this looks like. So you've got a set of servers. So here, let's just kind of depict, here's our four servers. these are going to be nodes in the cluster. They're domain joined. So they're in a domain. They're in the same domain. They're member servers. They're not domain controllers.
And they're not part of the cluster yet.
And then as you're forming the cluster, what's going to happen is that within Active Directory, you'll see you got Active Directory, kind of the light blue box, and then you have an OU, and your OU is that container, that group. And so what happens is that when you'll see that there are computer objects for each individual server. So I've got four servers, and I've got kind of in that green, I've got four computer objects, one associated with each server. And that's not something special. The clustering for you're going to join any laptop, desktop to the domain, you're going to have a computer object associated with it. Now, what's unique about clusters is that we create computer objects associated with those with the names on a cluster. So here you'll see there's actually three computer objects additionally. So one is called the CNO, which is the cluster name object, and that is the computer object that is created associated with the cluster name, which is the name when you set up the cluster. And that is your management point when you're going to manage the cluster. And then for all the applications you may install, so like say for each SQL instance you install, you're going to have an additional name which is bound to the system. And we move that name around across the nodes and when we fail over the SQL instance. So when the name is when a SQL instance is online in node 1, we're going to bind the name to it. The clients will then resolve and connect to that node. If we fail over, we will then unbind the name from that node, bind it to this one, and clients will connect. And then we will create a what we call a VCO, or virtual computer object, associated with those names. So CNOs for the cluster name for management, VCOs are all the other application names following that. I just talked about this. So when you look at the CNO and the VCO, so again, and it's kind of we use them as for two purposes. One of which is for doing Kerberos authentication against the name. So when you want to connect to an application, whether it be SQL or file share, you probably want to do Kerberos authentication against that share. And so by having computer objects associated with that name allows us to do Kerberos authentication. The second thing we use these computer objects for is a common identity inside the cluster. So within the cluster, we will use the computer account to be able to authenticate to the different nodes in the cluster and be able to access the other nodes in the cluster. So it's kind of, we're using computer objects as a common identity. And if you're familiar with managed service accounts, you can think of what we're doing was kind of as the first generation of managed service accounts as kind of the general purpose implementation of what we did. So when you're setting up your cluster, so let's talk about when you set up your cluster. So when you go to install a failover cluster, you're going to install the failover clustering feature. Simon, I think, are you going to demo this a little later?
I am, yep.
So you're going to get to see this in a second. So you install the failover clustering feature, you're going to run validate, and then you're going to run create cluster. So you're going to log in locally into the server using a domain user account. So you will log in, you know, I'm Eldon, so I'm going to log in to the domain as Eldon with my domain user account. My user account must be, to set up a cluster, you must be logged into the domain user account. That domain user account must be a member of the local administrators group on all the nodes in the cluster. So I have administrative rights to go and remotely connect those servers and set up the service. So what will happen is I sit down, I open Failover Cluster Manager, I'm logged on with my domain user credentials, and then and I go and run it. And I actually will use my user credentials to go out to Active Directory and then go and create those computer objects. So we'll use my credentials that I'm logged on with to go create that computer object in Active Directory. So what's different about a virtual computer object? They operate a little differently. So once we get the cluster up and running and get that CNO created, we want the cluster to be completely self-managing. And so to do that, so if you think about it, so you will then, when you go to set up a SQL instance, you log on with, a file server. When you go and log on with your user account, you will then go and launch Failover Cluster Manager. And Failover, what's different if you look at the second box, the cluster service will actually use the CNO as credentials to go access AD. And then the CNO is the one who goes and creates the computer objects associated with the other names, and it goes and creates them and puts them in the same OU as the CNO. So that's the virtual computer object. So when you do this, you need to have some permissions to be able to accomplish this. So the first part is that when you are setting up the cluster and creating the cluster, the account, your account which you log on with, has to have some permissions. First off, you have to have create computer objects permissions. You need to be able to create those computer objects in Active Directory. You need to have read all properties permissions, and you need to have reset password to be able to set the password on the computer object. Now, what's kind of a little different is that on the CNO, you also have to grant it permissions on the OU. The CNO itself has to have create computer objects. That's so it can create all those VCOs. The CNO also has to have read all properties and reset passwords, because it's going to reset its own password, rotate it every 30 days, just like a normal computer object. So those are just some requirements when setting up your cluster. Now, you can go and pre-stage computer objects. So there's kind of, in some enterprise environments, they're highly secure and no domain admins, or I should say server admins, have permissions to create computer objects in Active Directory. In that case, the domain admin can go and create the computer objects and pre-stage them and put them in the OU, and you can leverage them as well.
And so what happens? So basically, I have access to Active Directory. I go create the computer objects, and then would I go and tell the cluster administrator, here's the name of the cluster that you need to use, or how would that kind of handoff work?
Yeah, so what will happen is that the server admin would tell the domain admin what the name of the server they want to create. So they'll go and create a computer object with that name. They'll put it in a disabled state, and then they'll grant the user account of the server admin full control permissions onto that computer object. So that way, the server admin can create the cluster. He will then have permissions to hijack that computer object and set the permissions, and then it will, and then everything will work, and it will enable the computer object, and those are the permissions you need. So the next question is, where is cluster going to go create these computer objects? So it's going to go create them. And so here's kind of the heuristics we use. So when you go to create the computer object, the first thing is when you set up your nodes and you join them to the domain, those nodes are going to have their computer objects in Active Directory, and they're going to be in some OU. Might be in the default computers container, or maybe you've delegated permissions to a specific OU and you've put those computer objects in a specific OU. We are going to use that same logic. So when you set up the cluster, we're going to figure out, hey, what OU are the nodes in? And then we're going to go create the CNO in the same OU as the nodes. And then the VCOs follow the CNO as a hint. So, and the VCOs will be created in the same OU as the CNO. So that's kind of the general flow. So nodes get created in OU when you set up the servers. CNO uses the nodes as a hint. VCOs use the CNO as a hint. And then it goes and puts all those computer objects in the same OU and keeps them all together. So let's talk about clusters in a secure DNS zone. So first off, I was talking about we use computer objects for two things, right? We use them for doing Kerberos authentication against these names on a cluster. The second thing we use is a common identity. We use this common identity if you have a secure DNS zone. So if you have an AD integrated DNS zone, and we use the computer object associated with the CNO to be able to go and create those computer objects. So you need to make sure that the CNO has permissions to create DNS records when setting up AD. So that's just another thing. And we also ACL those DNS records to the CNO. So if you actually delete the cluster completely and the computer objects, and then you create a new cluster, clean up those DNS records, the new setting up the cluster won't have access to them. So you'll have to go and correct permissions on them. Another thing was we also support clusters on perimeter networks. So let's say you're setting up a cluster which is outside of the firewall, which is on a perimeter network, and you have only read-only domain controllers. So I said clusters need access to domain controllers. Traditionally, you have read-write domain controllers, but on a perimeter network, you might only have read-only DCs. We do support that. You do need to be running Windows Server 2012 or later. That was a new feature we added in Windows Server 2012. And it is a little bit involved. We have a blog, which is linked at the bottom. It is something we support, but it is a little more involved. You have to pre-stage the computer objects on the writable DCs and then replicate them out to the read-only DCs. So it's a little bit more involved, but can absolutely be done.
A good scenario where we actually see this is in a lot of retail or kind of fast food restaurants, where you have lots and lots and lots of little offices. You still need high availability for your, computing systems, for your databases, yet you don't want to give that little branch full access to the environment. So this is probably one of the most common places where we see these clusters that are created with access to only the read-only domain controllers.
And now the next one is about... So I talked about at the beginning, there's two modes to install the cluster. So there's the traditional mode that you've maybe known for the last decade, where for every name that we create in a cluster, we're going to create a computer object associated with that. And then I said there's two modes and we're going to talk about them. So now I'm going to fork for a second. So there's the traditional model I've been talking about, where we create computer objects for every name. But we also have these Active Directory detached clusters, which is a new feature that came in Windows Server 2012 R2. And so what this enables you to do is to create a cluster. Now, the servers still have to be domain joined themselves. The servers have to be domain joined. But you can create a cluster without having to create computer objects associated with it. So here's the real scenario for doing this. So let's say you're setting up a SQL Server. and you're using SQL Auth. So if you set up a SQL Server using SQL Auth, we kind of put this giant burden on you in historically that you have to go contact, you have to create these computer objects. If you don't have permissions, you have to go contact your domain admin. And the reality is you're not doing curb authentication against the name. You're not against the name. You're using SQL Auth. So now, if you're a SQL admin, you may want to set up a cluster that's Active Directory detached so you don't have to create those computer objects and kind of reduce all that overhead and burden. So some considerations with that. So there's some things that do and don't work with Active Directory detached clusters. So the first thing is that there is no computer objects, which means there is no curb, right? So that means that if you are going to do Windows authentication, so if you're going to do SQL Windows Auth, or you're going to set up like a file share, you're going to do NTLM authentication against that share. You probably want to do curb, going to give you some better authentication. So some better security. So just ways, and there's some features that don't work at all, such as MSMQ. And the reason is MSMQ actually places some attributes in the computer object. So it actually has a dependency of needing AD and needing a computer object. So just things to remember about Active Directory detached. Doesn't work at all with MSMQ. You can use it with a file server cluster, but you're not going to get that curb authentication against the name, so probably something you don't want to do. Now, another thing is with a Hyper-V cluster, can you set up an Active Directory detached Hyper-V cluster? Answer is yes, but Hyper-V uses the CNO, remember I said that common identity, to authenticate between nodes when doing live migration. So you're probably not going to want to deploy, that means live migration doesn't work on an Active Directory detached cluster. So yes, you could set up an Active Directory detached Hyper-V cluster, but you couldn't live migrate those VMs around, and that pretty much defeats the whole purpose of why I would even think about doing one. Now, the mainstream scenario for worth looking at this with Active Directory detached, and the way you should think about it is it's really for SQL Server. If you're doing SQL Server, you're doing SQL Auth, you can simplify your world by doing an Active Directory detached.
All right, well, I'm going to take it over from here as we start to talk about cluster validation. So what is cluster validation, first of all? So essentially, what we're trying to do here with cluster validation is provide you with a secure, easy to use and guided way to go and configure your cluster and to go and test it to ensure that it goes and actually supports the cluster. So essentially, think of this as a best practice analyzer in the box. It's a functional test tool. Now, this is also used for inventorying and indexing how the cluster is configured. If you have to go call product support, speak to them on the phone, very first thing they're going to do is ask you to run the full validation test and send them the report, because not only may it guide them to the root cause of the problem, but it's also going to lay out in detail the different nodes, the configuration, the workloads running on them, and all of those different private properties. So multiple uses for this validation tool. Now, there's six different categories of tests, and some of these tests may or may not appear just based on what type of cluster you're using. So first of all, if the cluster has already been created, you're going to get a whole set of best practice tests that we call our cluster configuration tests. These are basically ensuring that not only is the cluster going to run correctly, but the best practices are being followed. So for example, one of the tests is checking what type of check disk property you have on your cluster disks. Do you have fast check disk or traditional slower check disk? Let's say you have the traditional slower check disk. We're actually going to go and recommend that you change the property on that disk to the fast version so that when you have a failover, the disk will come online sooner. So again, it's not saying that the cluster's not going to work or not supported, but it's really guiding you on how to optimize it so you get a faster failover and higher availability. The second category that's unique and just to specific roles are the Hyper-V tests. And if you have Hyper-V installed on one or more nodes in the cluster, we're going to go and add this full set of tests as well to really try to ensure that the cluster is configured and optimized for Hyper-V. Beyond that, we have tests around inventory, which is going to list everything in the cluster, our network tests, our storage tests, and then system configuration tests, which check for things such as patching and update levels. Let's actually go and take a look at my demo, and we'll actually look at a live validation test and report. So I'm going to switch over here now to my failover cluster demo. Here you can see Server Manager, and if I wanted to go and install it, I would do everything through the manage, add roles and features. As Eldon mentioned before, failover clustering is an actual feature. So we'll go and see this not listed under the roles, but down here under the feature. Now, for the sake of time, for the sake of the demo, I've already gone ahead and installed this. So this is already enabled on my 3-node cluster. So next thing I'm going to do is go and launch Failover Cluster Manager. We could do that by going to our tools and clicking Failover Cluster Manager. I already have that open here. And so this is the basic interface that we use for managing our clusters. Now again, very first thing we want to do before building the cluster is make sure that my entire configuration is supported. So we're going to go ahead and say validate a cluster. This is going to go and ask us for the nodes which will be part of the cluster. So I could go specify dot for my first one, node 2, and using comma separation, node 3.
And you can just click add as well. So you can do them one at a time, or you can do the period, or if you put in the name of a node which has already joined the cluster, it will populate all the nodes automatically. So you got a 64-node cluster, it'll put them all in there for you.
That's true, absolutely. And one thing we quickly do here, it went so fast you didn't see it, we actually ensure that all of these cluster nodes have the feature installed. So that's the first test. Failover clustering has to be installed on all these nodes. So next thing it's going to ask is, do I want to run all of the tests, which is going to be required for support, or just a subset? Now, for the sake of the demo, I'm just going to run a subset of tests here, but I'll show you a complete validation report a little later.
So one of the questions I get really commonly when people are selecting those tests is, do they cause downtime? Or do any of these, does running validate, will it cause me downtime if I run validate on a configured cluster? And the biggest test is storage. So if you looked at the set of tests that Simon was selecting there, the one significant one is storage. So if you run storage on a configured cluster and you want to validate a disk which is in production, it will involve time. But all the other tests, you can remember that downtime. So if you're running validate as a diagnostic tool, just deselect the storage test and you can run it on production with no worries.
Awesome. So let's go ahead and in this demo, we'll actually go ahead and just select the system configuration test. So you can see we have a bunch here. We'll click next, and we'll go ahead and let this run in the background. Now, in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and open up this validation report that I ran last night and just kind of show you the different things we have here. Now, what you can see based on this high-level summary here is that I have 2 green checkboxes, and then I have 3 warnings. So what does this mean for support? Well, green means everything's configured correctly, and this warning means that the cluster is going to work, but a best practice isn't being followed. So if I take a look at my networking test, for example, I can drill down, and I see that this validate network communication test has given me a warning. It's saying your cluster will work, but you're not following a best practice because you only have a single networking interface between these 2 nodes. That is a single point of failure. So one of the best practices that we're not following. Now, if I go take a look at my system configuration tests, I scroll down to here, and I see a warning about my software update levels. It tells me that all of the servers do not have the same software updates. So Eldon, why is it a best practice to ensure that we have consistent software updates running across our different nodes?
Yeah, you want to make sure that when you're going to fail over that things are going to work consistently in the same. You don't want to have different binary versions between the node. And those warnings are really just kind of like a, hey, you should go check this out. So there's kind of the 3 levels. There's the green checkbox, everything is good. Go into production, you're great. There's the warnings, which are like, we're not quite sure. You might want to go take a look at this. And then, and if you're doing a converged network infrastructure, it's really validate saying, hey, we only detect a single interface. This might be a single point of failure. You need to go take a look at it. You as an admin might show up and go, oh, well, I've implemented NIC teaming under the covers. It only presents a single logical NIC, but under the covers, I have multiple physical NICs, NIC teaming. It's actually okay. So warnings are okay and you're still supported. It's just like, hey, you need to go check this out. But if you get an error, you get that red X going, not supported, and then that's not something that's going to be supported.
All right, great. So we'll let that run in the background. We'll let the rest of the validation test finish, and we'll jump back to the slides here. Now that we've covered actually validating and testing the cluster, let's go through creating it, what's required. So when we go and build this, you've already seen an interface just like this when we talked about validation. What we're actually looking at now is a similar wizard for creating the cluster. So we go specify the cluster names. We have the option to add storage if we want. So let's jump back to the demo and actually go build our cluster now. Pretty easy, just a couple of steps that we're going to take a look at.
One more thing I want to point out about validate. A lot of people will ask me, they'll say, when do I need to run validate? So the one scenario here is when you're setting up a cluster, you absolutely want to run validate. And when you make changes to the cluster, you probably want to run validate. Like we recommend, if you add a node to the cluster, if you add disk to the cluster, you want to test them. You want to make sure this thing's going to work. But ultimately, it's really up to you, and it's really the level of risk you want to take. So, for example, if you want to, some customers will say, hey, I'm a 24/7 shop. I can afford no downtime. You say running those storage tests is going to cause me downtime. I can't run them. That's a business choice, and that's okay. Now, I would recommend maybe running everything but the storage tests. That would be a good step. And if you call in and if you're having problems and you call support, they're going to ask you to run validate. And so it's really when we say running, it requires running validate to be supported. But at the end of the day, it's really about a business decision for you on if you're, how much risk you're willing to take. You don't run validate, higher risk.
Thanks. So let's jump back to Failover Cluster Manager in the demo here. Validation is just completed. And we're going to go through our second task here of creating the cluster. So again, we'll enter the name. So I'll put period for the current node, node 2, and node 3. We'll click add. We'll validate the features installed. Click next. Now, it's going to give us this warning about validation again and remind me, hey, you have not run all of the validation tests. You really need to do this. But again, for the sake of the demo, we're going to go and skip that.
You're a wild cowboy.
Uh-oh. Let's see what happens here. So the next thing it asks for is, what is the name of the cluster? So this is that client access point, this single location that we're going to go use to go connect. Because one thing that we conceptually want to try to think about clustering as is a single distributed system. Even though we have these multiple individual hosts running behind it, we really just want to think of this as one massive, distributed, highly available solution where things are kind of just fluid and move between them. But we want to simplify that management through the single entry point here. So we'll go ahead, enter a name. We'll click next. We're going to go verify that that name is free. And then down here, you'll see I have the option of adding all storage to the cluster or adding it manually later. So we'll go ahead and we'll say that we want to add. Now, Elder, while this gets created here, can you tell me the logic behind what gets considered available storage and why we would pick these particular disks to add them to the cluster or not?
Yeah, so kind of the criteria when you're adding storage to your cluster is, first off, that it needs to be block-based storage. It needs to be such as SAS, Fibre Channel, can't be SATA. So SATA doesn't support multi-initiator. Disks that are presented to more than one node, it needs to be a basic disk. It needs to be, I recommend NTFS or REFS. It could be FAT32. You really wanted to, you could cluster a FAT32 disk. I have never seen anybody do it, but you can do it. And it could be a space as well.
Great. So let's go back to the demo here. We can now see that the create cluster wizard has finished. And we actually see another report option. So when do we generate reports? It seems like we got different places, different locations where we'll actually create one of these.
Data. All the information you need to, we really want to overwhelm you. Not overwhelm is the right word, but we want to give you all the verbose information you need that if something goes wrong, you can troubleshoot it. But we try to, there's all these reports, you're right. So there's the validation report, create cluster report, all these different logs. But what we do is we stick them all in one location. So if you go to your C Windows cluster directory, you're going to see a reports directory. And in there is all the logs. So if you're having some problems and you need somebody to help you, you can just grab that whole reports directory, zip it up, send it off to somebody, and you're going to have everything you need in one spot.
All right. So I've gone and actually opened this up in the demo here. So you can see if we navigate C Windows Cluster Reports, it will list all of these different reports. Now, in this particular demo, you'll see I have a lot of reports. That's because I've been destroying, creating, reusing this cluster, and we're just keeping track of all of these different reports. But the only really active ones we would see from this particular instance would be validation and create cluster. All right, so now that our cluster's being created, let's go back to click finish here. We'll wait a second, and then Failover Cluster Manager is going to connect to this newly created cluster. So it's just going to take a second while it loads. While it does that, another thing to point out about the reports as well is we actually store copies of those reports on every single cluster node as well. So if one node is not accessible for any reason, we can just go to a different node, still get that same information. So we kind of make those reports redundant. All right, looks like Failover Cluster Manager is back, and we've gone and actually built our cluster. So just a quick tour here. When we go and click on our main Failover Cluster Management namespace, we see information about configuring roles, retesting the cluster, adding nodes. And then down here, we have this concept of what we call core cluster resources. Eldon, can you quickly walk us through what exactly are the core cluster resources? Why would we use them?
Yeah, so for example, one of which is going to be, we talked about the cluster name. So the cluster name is in that. So it's a group within the cluster, our core resources. So you get your cluster name, and then you have the IP addresses associated with that. And then you're going to have your witness resource in there as well, which will be either a disk witness or a file share witness, which will be in that group.
And we're going to be talking about the witness and quorum very, very shortly here.
Yep.
Further down, you'll see roles. This is where we would actually display the highly available workloads once we create them, such as our virtual machines or SQL servers. We have our nodes. So in this case, I have my 3-node cluster. And we'll talk about this concept of voting again in a little bit. Down here, we have storage. And this goes and lists all of our disks. We can see that we have about 7 disks here. Some of them are larger disks, some are smaller. But everything that I've actually configured for this particular demo is running on an iSCSI target behind the scenes. Down here under networks, we see that I have, only one network. So you saw that best practice that got flagged in the cluster validation report, warning me you only have a single network. This is what it's telling me here, so not following that best practice. And then finally, we have what we call the cluster events here. Eldon, what exactly is this, and how's the relationship between this and regular cluster eventing?
Yeah, so what that's going to do is that is actually going to is a mechanism to correlate all the events across the entire cluster. So when an event is logged, it is logged to the local event log. Well, if you're troubleshooting like an 8-node cluster, that can be very cumbersome to have to go to the open event viewer and all those different nodes and look at all those different events. So what that will do is actually reach out to all the nodes, pull all those events in, and give you a single consolidated view of all the events in the cluster.
All right, well, that's our quick tour of Failover Cluster Manager. Now we're going to jump back to our cluster management and talk about some of the best practices around here. Now, roles and features. We talked about this in our first module. Just a quick reminder, we want to support most of the key Windows Server features and roles. But what you're going to see throughout the rest of the day here is our focus on virtual machines and the Hyper-V role. Now, next concept we want to talk about is what we call a cluster group. Now, a cluster group is an organizational unit. It's the smallest unit of failover. And these are essentially all the objects related to a particular cluster workload. So with a traditional cluster group, we're going to have our network name. Now, the network name is our easy-to-access point. So let's say you have a DHCP server. The friendly name might be, you know, corp DHCP, something like that. Behind the scenes for that particular network name are underlying IP addresses so that we could go connect to those particular resources if we need. And again, you can use static or DHCP. We then have the particular application that's made highly available. In this particular example, I have a file server. And then finally, we have a physical disk resource. So this is where the files for that particular file server will be stored. Now, virtual machines are slightly different here. With a virtual machine group, we have our virtual hard disk, and this could live on a traditional cluster disk or a cluster shared volume, and we'll kind of talk about the differences of those shortly. We have our virtual machine resource itself, and then we have the configuration file for the virtual machine. And this contains the, the description, the metadata for that VM, such as the name, the size, network connections, things like that. Now, when we think about planning our cluster networks here, of course, we want to make sure that we have all of these different networks pre-configured when we want to go create the cluster. It's much easier to go and build the cluster with all these different network components pre-configured. Again, make sure you use NIC teaming if possible, have redundant NICs, and then you need NICs for these different types of traffic patterns. Now, another best practice as well when you're looking at your networking interface cards is trying to take advantage of hardware-assisted acceleration features. And so a lot of hardware vendors are actually building basically processing capabilities inside the NIC card itself, so that the CPUs on the physical host don't have to do things such as traffic processing, encryption, decryption, things like that. So if you want to make sure that you're freeing up more cycles for the workloads like the VMs, take a look at these different hardware acceleration features on the network interface cards themselves. But that's not a topic that we're going to spend much time on here. Next topic I want to bring up with basic cluster management is around actually patching the clusters. Now, I used to run a bunch of clusters in one of our labs. I ran about 20 clusters at once, about 80 nodes, and cluster patching was one of my most painful days every single week back in the day. Then it got reduced to monthly.
Simon, you should have fixed that problem.
I did. How do we do that? Well, we designed a solution known as cluster-aware updating. So this was a new, is this a feature or a role? I'm going to go with feature.
Feature.
Since you're not going to point to the box and say this is my updater, right?
Yep.
Fair assumption. So this is a feature that essentially allows you to do automated patching of clusters. So it's going to be able to go and integrate with Windows Update. You essentially create a baseline, point it to a cluster, and then it's going to go through a process of essentially taking one cluster node at a time, patching it, and adding it back to the cluster. Now, when we do that, we are kind of careful that we don't apply a bad patch to every node in the cluster. So anytime you hit a problem during that, for example, the patch installation code failed, or the node didn't rejoin the cluster, or the node never rebooted, we're just going to stop the process, alert the admin, and have them go figure out what the problem is. Because what we don't want to go do is apply a bad patch to every node in the cluster, wipe out your infrastructure. So we do play it safe. When you're doing the patching as well, we don't just support Hyper-V clusters. We actually support all different types of clusters. So you could do it for SQL, file servers, any type of cluster. The benefit, of course, if you're doing this on a Hyper-V cluster, is that you could do live migration to move those VMs between different nodes without downtime. This is actually also supported on guest clusters as well. So if you have a virtualized cluster, we can still do the patching and do failover within the virtual machines. So a great way to kind of save up a lot of administrative time and overhead. All right, well, I'm now actually going to go turn it over to Eldon, and Eldon's going to start to talk about this model known as Quorum. Now, Eldon, you've mentioned these things like witnesses, disk, Quorum. Let's take people through the importance of why we need this Quorum model first.
All right, so let's talk about some of the challenges here as we look at Quorum. So let's say we got a set of servers, and as we look at the, and you want to bring down a node for patching. So you want to bring down this node and remove it from the cluster. Now let's say then you have another node crash, and you have conditions like, I want to add nodes to the cluster, I want to remove nodes from the cluster. You're going to have network problems where nodes are going to become partitioned from each other from the network. And you're going to have where you have failures of the of either storage or the file share witness. And you'll have site outages where you'll lose entire sites and all those nodes. So we have to survive that, and we have to make sure, how does the cluster stay up? So what Quorum is Quorum is a way that the cluster has to decide when it can't talk to other nodes in the cluster, what it should do. So imagine you have a two-node cluster, and there's a network partition between the two. You got two nodes, you got a partition between the two, and you want to avoid what we call split brain. And split brain is where you have two parts of the cluster which are still up and running and maintaining and thinking that they are the cluster. And then one of the core fundamentals of clustering is that we have to avoid split brain. And Quorum enables us to do that. So we have to know that when these two servers can't talk to each other, one of them has to decide, I should shut down, and the other one should stay up. So it's a mechanism of determining who should stay up and who should shut down, making sure that we avoid split brain and only one half of the cluster survives.
Now, what's the fundamental reason for avoiding split brain? Is it to avoid having, let's say, two instances of the same VM running, writing to that same disk?
Right. You don't want to have two servers up and running, think they're independently the cluster. They're both trying to run that virtual machine. They're both trying to access the storage. We need to elect one server to win, one server to host that virtual machine, and make sure that the other one gracefully gets removed and out of the cluster and doesn't try to access it.
I guess it's to avoid those uncoordinated writes to the disk, to avoid any type of corruption, things like that.
Yep.
But don't worry, we protect against all of that using this.
Absolutely. So when you're thinking about, so the first part is that when you're thinking about Quorum, Quorum is majority. So we need a majority of votes for the cluster to stay up and running. Votes can be assigned to different things. They can be assigned to nodes, and each node will get one vote, and a witness, and the witness will get one vote. So let's take that simple two-node cluster. So I got a two-node cluster, one node, another node, and then you want to create a witness, and you can assign only one witness, and that witness gets one vote. Now the witness can be either a disk, so we can either be that we use like a LUN to act as a as an arbitration point and decision maker when two nodes can't talk to each other, or it could be an SMB share, and then we use a file, and then we go and arbitrate over that file to decide who should stay up and who should drop out. And so there's a vote assigned to each one. So you have one node, one vote for node one, one vote for node two, and one and vote for the witness. So that's three votes. So I need a majority. So I need two out of three votes for the cluster to stay up. So what that means is that if I have a three-node cluster and node one crashes, right, I got node two, it's got the witness, it stays up and running. But let's take a network partition. Let's say that the witness is owned by node two, and there's a partition. Node one and two can't talk to each other. They have to decide who stays up and who shuts down. What'll happen is they'll both try to go for the witness, and whoever wins the witness will then win that vote. So node two is up, it's got the witness, it will defend it. So you got one vote, two votes from the witness, two out of three is majority. This node says, I stay up. This node tries to get to the witness, he can't get it. He'll say, I got myself one vote, that's it. One out of three, one out of, is not majority, I'm gonna shut down. So that's fundamentally how quorum works, is it's about achieving a majority of votes. So actually here is just kind of the ways which you can configure quorum. So you can actually, if you want to, in kind of the Windows 2003 model, you can assign a vote just to the disk. We don't really do this anymore. It's kind of the way we did it a decade ago because the disk is a single point of failure, but you could assign a vote only to the disk and whoever wins the disk or it wins, but we don't really do that anymore. Now you can, what I was just talking about, you'll have a vote for each of the nodes in the cluster and the witness. So here you can see I have a four node cluster with a vote for each node. That's four votes plus the witness, that's five. I need three out of five for the cluster to stay up. You can assign it to a file share witness. So in this case, same thing, five votes. Doesn't matter if it's a disk or file share. It's a single vote. You have five votes. You need a five out of it. You can also just do the nodes and not have a witness if you wanted to. And you can do the nodes and the file share we talked about. Now, but the key thing here is that our recommendations with Windows Server 2012 has really evolved. And we'll go through the changes why. But we really want to have... you want to have a vote for each node, and you always want to configure a witness. And we'll talk about dynamic witness and why you want to do that now. So disk witness considerations. So this is what we'll commonly refer to as the quorum disk. It uses a single point for arbitration. It stores a copy of the cluster database, and we recommend creating a dedicated disk. So you don't want to put data on it. You don't want to put your SQL databases. You want a dedicated lung carved up just for the witness. We want it to be NTFS. It could be REFS. NTFS is probably fine. And you don't even need to sign a drive letter. And we want it to be at least 512 megs in size. A lot of people just create a gig. So just a 1 gig volume, NTFS. Simple, don't put anything on it. Don't even drive letter, you won't see it.
And just to clarify, this is going to be like a regular cluster disk as well, just like we saw in that interface where I saw those seven disks.
Yep.
So it gets managed by the cluster, like a, I guess like a normal cluster disk.
Yep. Yeah. And so as we look to Windows Server 2012, we really wanted to simplify our quorum goals and how things work. So the quorum model has really evolved from 2003, significantly changed in 2008, 2008 R2, 2012, 2012 R2. So if you're used to the way clustering used to work, it's really evolved in the way things are now. So let's talk about some file share witness considerations before we get into those. So when using a file share as a witness, it can be, you want to have a create a single dedicated share for the witness. Now you can have multiple clusters, you get 10 clusters, use the same witness. We will create a directory under there with a GUID and we'll keep them unique and differentiated. But you wanna have at least one share and don't put, you know, Word docs and users and things like that. So a dedicated share. If you're setting up a multi-site cluster, we'll talk about that later, we want it in a third site, and you don't want to put in a VM on top of the cluster because that would kind of defeat the purpose. So you want to have an SMB share out on some remote file server, which is not in the cluster, not in a VM on top of the cluster, but out on some remote server. And anything running SMB, actually anything 2008 or higher is fine. So we've kind of evolved the way we think about, so I talked about some of this evolution as we've gone through the releases. So we've introduced this concept we call kind of dynamic quorum. So I talked about that the cluster, so let's take that five vote cluster. So we had those four nodes and that fifth vote. You really need what we've changed in 2012 is that we now dynamically change the vote of the node based off of the membership in a cluster. So it used to be that total quorum was determined by the number of nodes in cluster. If you had a four-node cluster, you always had four votes. Now it's defined by being an active membership in the cluster. So you have a four-node cluster with a fifth with a witness. So let's say I power down a node. What's going to happen is now I have three nodes and a witness. We will actually go and drop the vote for the node. So now instead of having a majority of 5, I need a majority of 4. Actually, what's interesting is that what we do now with dynamic witness is we will detect that we have an even number of votes in the cluster, and we will actually drop the vote for the witness. So now you'll be down to 3 votes for the 3 nodes, and if you need a majority of 3 for the cluster to stay up. If you now power down another node, you'll be down to 2 nodes, and you'll be even. So what we'll do is that dynamic witness, we will flip that vote back on for the witness, and you'll be back up to 3 votes. And again, you'll need a majority of 3 votes.
So is it best practice to always have an odd number of votes?
Total,
regardless of what's coming up or down, right? We're always going to want to try to have 3 active votes or 5 active, or?
You always want to have a witness. And if you configure a witness, we will always make sure there's an odd number of votes, because we will toggle the vote of the witness on or off depending on the membership of the cluster and the number of nodes to make sure it's always odd.
Okay. So, and we'll actually demo that in a little bit as well. I've got that set up for our demo.
All right. So when deciding which witness should I use? You get a disk witness, you get a faster witness. They both do the same sort of thing. Which one should I use? Golden rule, if you got shared storage, use a disk. It's a little bit better than a file share. So if you think about split brain, that's our huge value. Both will solve that, disk and file share. Both will prevent the partition in time. So when we talk about preventing, let's talk about partition in time. So partition in time is I have 2 nodes that are up and running. They're both synchronized as far as the state. I created a resource. Now I power down this node. This node's up and running. I make some changes to it. I add another resource. Now I power this node down. Can't talk to each other, both down, then I power this one up. Now, he never got the changes from this guy because he was down when they were made. That's what we call a partition in time. So with a disk witness, we actually store a copy of the cluster database out on the disk, and when that node comes up, it'll pull down that updated database from the disk. We don't do that with a share. So with a share, we will detect that this node doesn't have the most current version of the database, and we'll actually prevent it from starting. But if you have a disk witness, we'll pull it down. So golden rule is the only thing to remember is if you have shared storage, use a disk witness. Otherwise, use file share witness.
Now, when I actually go and create a cluster, it seems like the core remote gets configured for me. Can you kind of elaborate on what's happening there?
Yeah, so what we're doing is that the default mode is we're going to give everything a vote. We're going to assign all the nodes a vote. And then if we find shared storage, we're going to create a disk witness automatically. And we will select the smallest disk that is larger than 500 megs. So we'll find the smallest disk larger than 500 megs. We will automatically select it as a disk witness. Now, we talked about each node automatically has a vote, and we toggle that vote automatically determined on whether the node is in cluster membership or not. That is actually configurable. So if you want to, you can say, you know what, here's a node, I never want to have a vote. Most common scenario is disaster recovery. We'll get into that a little bit. But if I have a disaster recovery, I have some nodes in the DR side, I may not want them to have a vote. You can actually manually configure them not to have a vote, and they will never have a vote in membership, a majority. And see, this is just what I was just talking about. I got a little ahead of myself. So you can in a DR scenario, configuring that node not to have a vote. So you can actually go. So if we look at this, so if I manually configure the vote, here's 4 nodes. Normally they would all have a vote, but I can manually toggle that 4th node so it has 0 vote. So now I have, even though I have 4 nodes in the cluster up and in membership, I have to have 3 out of 4 in that last node. So if I lost node 1, I would have 2 votes between 2 and 3. I wouldn't have 3 votes, because remember, node 4 has no vote in membership at all. All right, so let's talk a little bit about how you can adjust these weights. So we actually have a quorum configuration wizard that you can go in and dynamically modify the weights. You can either set it to all the nodes having vote, you can select the ones that have it, or you can say none of the nodes, which is kind of the disk witness that we don't, just the disk only, we don't recommend, but you can go and configure it. It's also from PowerShell as well. So let's say you want to determine who has a vote or not. You're going to show in the demo.
Yeah, we will take a quick look at this one as well.
Yeah, so you can see this from our GUI. You'll see the current vote and the assigned vote. And you can also see it when you run validate. So if somebody runs validate, sends you a report, you'll be able to see what the configured weights are as well. And I talked about dynamic quorum and how we will dynamically change the vote of the quorum based off of whether the node's in and out of membership. And what this is this really, so let's talk about the scenario, the big scenario and why. So in Windows Server 2012, we introduced 64 node cluster support. But in the old model, core model of 2008, 2008 R2, you had to have 50% of the votes up for the cluster state.
More than 50.
More than 50. So you have a 64-node cluster, and you shut down 32 nodes, the whole cluster goes down. Well, you still got 32 nodes. You can still host a lot of VMs on 32 nodes.
It's a lot of server.
And so that didn't make sense. So what we wanted to do is to really make that dynamic, that the cluster will be dynamically adjusting as membership of the nodes changes. So as those nodes are powering down, we will dynamically readjust quorum. And you can actually take a 64-node cluster and power it all the way down to one node, and the cluster will survive. Now, those 8,000 VMs may not run on that one node, but it will survive. And that's what, you know, so it really gives you that last man standing. And it's enabled by default. You can toggle it off if you want. I don't know why anybody would, but it's there in case you want to turn it off as well. And so in Windows Server 2012 R2 is when we really changed. We also take that logic and we brought it to the witness as well. So that's why I talked about we will dynamically toggle the vote of the witness on and off depending on the number of nodes in the cluster. And we're really going to keep that number odd. No matter how many nodes are up or down, we're going to use the witness on or off. And you can go and view it, and you can change it if you want. You can disable dynamic quorum if you want. And then there's some properties that you can go and see the weight of the cluster. Again, you can see them from the GUI, and you can see them through PowerShell. And so, again, we talked about that dynamic quorum is really going to give you that node shutdown. And let's talk a little bit about node crash. So let's say I have a 5-node cluster. So what cluster can survive now is that you can survive a simultaneous loss of up to 50% of the nodes in the cluster. So I have a 5-node cluster, and if 2 nodes instantly crash, remember I got 3 nodes which survive, so that's 3 out of 5, the cluster stays up. Now let's take this scenario. So I have a 5-node cluster, and this node crashes, and then 10 seconds later we will regroup and come into a single, now we have a majority of 4, and then let's say this one crashes, now we have a majority of 3, and then this one crashes, now we have a majority of 2. So it's all about simultaneous failures, and we will regroup and adjust things over time. So what happens if we have an exact 50-50 split? So let's take this scenario. So here I have a 4-node cluster. It's a stretch cluster stretched across 2 data centers. And I have a WAN failure. So I have 2 nodes in site 1, I have 2 nodes in site 2, I have this breaking connectivity between the two. Now what's going to happen? I have 4 nodes, 4 votes, I need 3 out of 4 for majority for the cluster to stay up. But if I have a split right down the middle, each side only has 50%. So what we will actually do now is that we will elect a side to win. So if we have an exact simultaneous 50-50 split in the cluster, we will elect one side to win. So one side, we have a deterministic algorithm. You can control it with this lower node node priority, lower quorum priority node ID. You can say that
That's an easy one, huh?
That was a dev that did that. That was a dev who came up with that naming. But you can, and that allows you to control which side will win. So you can always say, I always want my primary data center to win in the event of a 50-50 split and the DR center side to shut down. So we will even survive a 50-50 split now. So it used to be, yeah, in 2008, 2008 R2, you had to have more than 50, but now we actually got it down to, we're dynamically adjusting the nodes and node weights, witness weight, we're 50-50 split will survive, so.
So I guess really kind of the key goal here is we're trying to make it simple for people now, right? I guess try to have less pressure on the administrator to have to worry about the quorum model because we're constantly kind of changing those, tweaking the knobs for you.
Yeah, I mean, did you write the white paper? There was some...
Yeah, I did.
We have this ridiculous, like, 20-page long white paper about how to configure quorum on a cluster. It's pretty ridiculous. You wrote it, and it was so complex and so hard. So that's why over the last several releases, we've really tried to make quorum easy. Just give all... You don't have to do anything. Just set up the cluster. I'm telling you all this advanced stuff, but the reality is just install the cluster. We'll give all the nodes a vote. You configure a witness, which will do automatically if you have shared storage, and we will dynamically just do everything for you under the covers. You don't have to worry about anything. That's the key message. And this shows where the wizard is, but I'm going to skip this as you're going to go into the demo. Another thing you can do is you can actually... Now, there may be times where a node... Let's take this DR scenario. Let's say you had 3 nodes in the primary and 2 nodes in the secondary. Let's say there's a disaster and there's a tornado and site 1 loses power and is down. Now, the secondary site simultaneously lost 3 out of 5 nodes. It's more than 50%. So these 2 nodes do not have majority and they will automatically shut down.
And that first site's offline as well. That can't be recovered as well, right? So we've lost those three.
Yeah, so those three are gone. The second two are now shut themselves down. So now the whole cluster's down. So what Force Quorum is a way for you as an administrator to have a manual override switch. So when you determine that you've determined that there's a tornado, site one is gone, it is never coming back. Site two has shut itself down because it didn't have quorum. It's a way for you as an administrator to go pull that manual switch to say, start these nodes on the site. I know you guys don't have quorum, but it's okay. I'm doing a manual override. You now have quorum and you now start. And so that's what it'll do is it'll now go and force quorum on those sides and allow you to do an override for disaster recovery.
Now, we always have the opposite of that as well, prevent quorum. What exactly is that?
Yeah, so prevent quorum is the inverse of that. So that actually prevents the cluster service from starting. So you can actually say that you don't want the cluster service to start. So the scenario that we kind of came up with that was that if you had a three nodes and a two nodes and they became partitioned and you didn't want the nodes to actually automatically start and form a cluster. So let's say you had a partition between these two. You forced quorum over here to get the cluster up and running, but now these sides actually have majority. They can actually start a cluster. You can actually do prevent quorum, which will say, hey, do not go and form quorum. You guys, even though you have a majority of votes, you need to go talk to somebody else over here before you go and start. So force quorum resiliency. So kind of this was actually a real scenario that a customer brought to us. So the scenario here was that they had three nodes running in the primary data center, two in the secondary. They had a partition between the two, and there was a tornado that actually came through. Tornado came through, knocked out communications to the data center, but the data center was still up. So what happened is the three nodes in the primary data center had quorum, they could talk to each other, stayed running, but nobody could get to them because the data center lost all the network connectivity. So the admins went to the DR site, did a force quorum, got those two nodes up and running. But now I have forced a split brain, right? I got three nodes up and running.
Three and a two, right? Yep.
Three and a two, and I got those other two up and running. I have forced a split brain. So what happens when eventually, and they couldn't get to the data center to shut down the servers, the police had blocked all the roads, they couldn't get to the data center to shut down those servers in the primary site. So eventually, the telecoms fixed communication to the data center. But what happens when you have a three-node partition of the cluster and a two-node partition of the cluster, and suddenly they can communicate again when they fix the connectivity?
I don't know. I guess there's some inconsistency with the databases, yeah. Right? Things are out of sync. Who wins?
So our answer used to be, run real fast. Like, get your car and drive to the primary data center as fast as you can and shut down those nodes as fast as you can in the primary data center. But that wasn't a very good answer. We, you know, had to buy people a bunch of fast cars and so running shoes. And so, but that wasn't a very good answer. So now what we will do is that if we detect that a partition in the cluster has been authoritatively had an override with force quorum, we know that that side is authoritative and it's been a user intent. So if another partition of the cluster detects the side which has been force quorum, we will say, aha, there's been a manual override. This is a side that is authoritative. We're going to shut down the other side. So that's the new resiliency we have.
All right, great. I think I'm going to take it away with a demo now. So let's go ahead and switch over to my system here. And we are back to looking at the disks. Now, if you notice here, one of the disks here is the disk witness in quorum. And the way this was picked, as Eldon mentioned, is going to be the smallest disk that's larger than 512 megabytes. So as we went and added these seven disks to the cluster, we went and we selected that smallest one. So here we have our disk witness. Now let's go ahead and take a look at the nodes here. Nodes. And under the nodes, you're going to see these two options for assigned vote and current vote. And so what this is, these are those quorum properties saying this node has one vote and is currently using one of those votes. Now what this means is, since I have these three nodes running in the cluster, I have 1, 2, 3 votes, this disk is turned off. So even though it's reserved to be used as that witness disk, it's not going to give a vote so that my total number of votes are still 3. Let's go ahead and simulate the failure of one of my nodes. Now, Failover Cluster Manager has this task of stopping the cluster service, and this is kind of like simulating failing the cluster crashing. So if we go ahead and stop the cluster service, this node is no longer in the cluster, so it's not voting. And check this out. The current vote has now dropped down to 0. So what this means is node 1 has one vote, node 2 has our second vote, and our disk witness has our third vote. So essentially, we've gone and toggled this disk voting. If I go back to my cluster and I restart the cluster service, we're then going to see this current vote jump back to 1 once it rejoins the cluster, and we're then going to go turn off that vote for the disk so that we maintain that exact odd number of votes at 3. Now, if we want to go do advanced configuration here for our core, we could go select the cluster name, go to More Actions, and click this wizard, Configure Cluster Quorum Settings. Under here, it gives us a couple options. It could say, use the default, select which of my disks is going to be the witness, or do some advanced configuration. So let's take a look at that quickly. Under our advanced configuration, this is where we can select the different voting. So if I want to make sure that node 3 never votes, maybe it's at my DR site or something, or I want to say none of the nodes are going to vote, just using the disk, but not recommended. But in this case, we'll just keep the default. We'll go through all nodes. We could go and select our disk, select a file share, do not select a disk, and essentially this wizard gives us all of the options that we want to go and really have that flexibility with the quorum. But our best practice is stay with the default when the cluster is built, because we're automatically trying to figure out what's right for you. All right, well, that wraps up our section on quorum. We're now going to take it away and quickly talk about cluster upgrades. So this is working with the assumption that you have an existing cluster, and now you're moving to our latest platform, Windows Server 2012 R2. First key thing here is that in-place upgrades are not supported. So this means when you go and click on setup.exe, first window you see is, do you want to do an upgrade, a clean installation? You have to go do a clean installation. If you do not, you're actually going to see an error pop up. And the reason for this, we just really want to make sure that that cluster node is completely clean. The database is clean, the registry is clean, to make sure that we have no inconsistencies on the new version. Since high availability is so critical, so important, we want to ensure that you have a clean, basic surface that you're going to start to build your clusters on top of. Now, step two, when we actually go and after we've done the upgrade on a node, we go and run our migration wizard. This migration wizard is part of Failover Cluster Manager. It's not part of the server migration tools. And this basically allows us to go and copy resource groups or virtual machine groups from the old cluster over to the new cluster. Now, key thing here is this requires two clusters. You have to have the existing cluster, and then you have to go have your new cluster as well. So when we have these two different clusters, you got to keep in mind that you're going to be changing the name of that cluster as well after the migration is complete. So one of the common questions is, okay, I have a two-node cluster. How do I go and do this, right? How can I go and have two clusters and do this migration if I only have two nodes? Well, what we have to do here is we evict one of our nodes. So we have a single one-node cluster. We then do the clean installation, add the new version. So we have our old cluster, our new cluster, they're both one nodes, and then we go and copy those roles between them. So this is still possible even with a two node cluster. Just kind of got to go through a series of incremental steps. If you have, let's say, a 16 node cluster, maybe you do 8 nodes at a time when you do this move. Other things to keep in mind here is we don't do anything destructive. When we go and copy these roles from our old cluster to the new cluster, we don't go and bring them online on the new cluster. So it's almost like you get a chance to kind of test things, see whether things are going to work before you actually make the switch and bring the applications online on the new cluster. And we generate rich migration reports before you actually perform it, telling you what's going to work, additional manual steps you may need to do, as well as a post-migration report that kind of details those manual steps that you must have to do. As we go through this, another important thing to note is VM migration is actually slightly different. It's easier. When we're migrating our VMs, we can actually do a live migration from our 2012 to our 2012 R2. It's not supported on the earlier versions. Nevertheless, we still need our two clusters. So we still need our old cluster, our new cluster, when we're migrating between the two. We do support migrating with CSV disks and remapping VM networks. So let's say on your old cluster you have CorpNet 1, on your new cluster you use CorpNet 2. We'll actually go through the wizard and allow you to map those different network settings. And as part of the migration process, we will go and upgrade the virtual machine's configuration file, remap it to the new network so that those VMs are going to function after the migration. Now, we did try to make this flexible. We said that you can kind of test things out before you start. You can migrate between Enterprise, which was an old SKU, Standard Edition, Data Center Edition, Core and Full, physical clusters to guest clusters, flexibility on the IP addresses, dynamic, static, different subnets. But there are some limitations. The wizard does not migrate anything, so there are certain roles which do have their own migration solutions on a cluster. Our DFS replication, you can replicate to the new cluster. Exchange has moving mailboxes and folder replication. Print has its own migration tool. Our remote desktop connection broker, they have a similar migration story. And SQL Server, they have their own migration tool with the SQL upgrade wizard. That wraps up our second module of the day, where we talked about our cluster upgrades and migration. We will be back shortly, where Elder is going to really kind of take us through the intricacies of cluster networking. Thank you.